Some say that he does have ties to Muslim extremists. I don't know.
A country of nearly 10 million people, Sweden is usually referred to as a utopian society, mainly for its cradle-to-grave welfare state. Politicians like Bernie Sanders and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez have heaped praise on Sweden as the political system of their dreams. Yet this Swedish model is uglier than it might appear to be. As Swedish stand-up comedian Magnus Bettner once said, "We're a nation of beautiful people singing happy songs in stylish modernist apartments. But that's not how we Swedes see ourselves. We have a very, very dark side, and I think you're only just finding out about it now." For more than a century, Swedes from Alfred Nobel to teen climate activist Greta Thunberg have been lecturing the world on peace, justice and progress while turning a blind eye to the more disturbing elements of their own history. Swedes suppress the memory of their nation's long-standing slave trade as one of the pillars of their economy. The country was also a major supplier of iron chains used in the slave trade. The Swedes traded slaves up to the mid-19th century. During most of World War II, the Swedes had a willing collaboration with Nazi Germany, even while technically maintaining neutrality. In the words of Elisabeth Asbrink, Sweden managed to maneuver itself through the war without officially taking sides, so all the people in Sweden who wanted Hitler to win, and there were many of them, never had to deal with the consequences of the stigma that collaborators in the occupied countries received. They also don't discuss the 63,000 of their fellow citizens who were forcibly sterilized right up until 1976 to keep the welfare system free of children who might inherit mental or physical disabilities. In fact, Sweden has never been an ideal place for women. The country's rape statistics are among the highest in Europe. In Sweden, almost every second, a woman reports lifetime exposure to some kind of serious violence, of which 65% is sexual harassment and 20% is sexual violence.
As a woman, you know that these things happen, but that what was overwhelming was that it was so common, and especially the testimonies from the cultural sector, from artists, from actresses. I feel quite encouraged and empowered by all these testimonies from different sectors of the Swedish society, that the tolerance on sexual harassment is really over now.
Rape survivors in Sweden continue to face barriers in accessing justice, and few investigations have led to prosecution and conviction. Moreover, Sweden is a destination country for women trafficked from countries such as Romania, Russia, and Nigeria for the purpose of commercial sexual exploitation. Meanwhile, around 25,500 cases of abuse against children below 18 years of age were reported to the Swedish authorities in 2020. A 2006 report released by Global Monetary on the commercial sexual exploitation of children found systemic faults in Sweden, including allowing child pornography to be viewed and failing to care properly for children caught up in sex trafficking.
The sexual exploitation of vulnerable people, vulnerable children, is never acceptable. But when it is perpetrated by people in positions of power, people we entrust to help and protect, it rightly sickens and disgusts, and it should compel us to take action.
A steep increase in immigration since 2011 has tested the limits of Swedish generosity. Back in November 2021, Stockholm abandoned its heroic rhetoric of welcoming refugees just to adopt the harsh language only far-right nativists of the Sweden Democrats Party used in 2015. Sweden now forcibly returns asylum seekers despite the worsening security situation in the country of origin.
Really, I don't know, because yesterday I seen the TV and the internet. This is, I think this is not really, because this is writing this 80,000 people go back to the country. but which people, which country, I don't know. And I think it is only speak.
On the other hand, racism is blighting Swedish society, and people of African descent face daily harassment and hate crimes. The anti-immigration, anti-Islam Sweden Democrats is now the largest party in southern Sweden and the third largest party in the Swedish parliament. According to the UN Working Group of Experts of People of African Descent, a real fear within the communities, especially for young black men, is that they could be violently attacked at any time. As a result of structural racism, black people in Sweden have reduced access to healthcare and education, while the police view them as criminals rather than a vulnerable community that needs protection. While Sweden is no longer open to the desperate people coming from war-stricken countries, it is still a safe haven for the Mujahedina Khalq organization, the MKO, a terrorist group which has assassinated tens of thousands of Iranian citizens since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Meanwhile, over the last 20 years, Sweden has gone from having one of the lowest to one of the highest levels of gun violence in Europe, worse than Italy or Eastern Europe. The increase in gun homicide in Sweden is closely linked to criminal melee in socially disadvantaged areas. Swedish Minister of Finance, Magdalena Andersson, boasted last year that her Swedish Social Democratic Party added 7,000 new police officers, built more prisons, and drafted laws creating 30 new crimes. In the land of generous welfare, the Roma people, primarily citizens of Romania and Bulgaria, continue to face discriminatory treatment, with many sleeping in tents or temporary settlements on the outskirts of the cities. Surprisingly enough, Stockholm has failed to recognize its own indigenous Sami people's rights.
The Swedish government needs to stop the colonization of Sápmi. We believe that the climate, the environment, clean air, water, reindeer herding, indigenous rights and the future of humanity should be prioritized before and above the short-term profit of a company, a British mining company.
The major preacher of human rights has been selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates since 1998, with most of the sales over the past decade. That's while the two Arab countries have been involved since 2015 in a bloody war against Yemen. There is no sign of a slowdown in this arms sales relationship. Sweden's arms manufacturer Saab opened an office in Abu Dhabi in 2017. The question is, how can Sweden be a peace broker if it's also selling the arms that make the war in Yemen possible? By and large, Sweden is using its undeserved benevolent reputation as a mask for serious violations of human rights on its soil.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Rudy Giuliani has been hit with ethics charges over baseless claims he made about the 2020 presidential election being stolen while serving as an attorney for former President Donald Trump. The charges come a day after a primetime hearing by the House panel investigating the Capitol attack. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, Rudy Giuliani Charged with Ethical Misconduct over Trump's big lie. In the United States, Rudy Giuliani has been hit with ethics charges over baseless claims he made about the 2020 presidential election being stolen while serving as an attorney for former President Donald Trump. The charges were filed on Friday, 10th of June, by the District of Columbia office that polices attorneys for ethical misconduct. The Washington, D.C. Office of Disciplinary Counsel alleges that Rudy Giuliani, who is a member of the D.C. Bar, made baseless claims in federal court filings about the results of the 2020 presidential election in Pennsylvania. The charges were filed with the District of Columbia Court of Appeals Board on professional responsibility. A lawyer for Rudy Giuliani did not have an immediate comment. The charges come a day after the U.S. House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack had its first primetime hearing, in which it outlined evidence that Donald Trump and his allies sought to overturn the 2020 election and incite throngs of Trump supporters to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's victory. Giuliani, a former U.S. attorney in Manhattan and a former mayor of New York City, has been among Donald Trump's most fervent supporters and repeatedly claimed without evidence that the election had been stolen. The complaint says Rudy Giuliani sought an emergency order to prohibit the certification of the presidential election, an order to invalidate ballots cast by certain voters in seven counties, and other orders that would have permitted the state's assembly to choose its electors and declare Trump the winner in Pennsylvania. The charges say his conduct violated two professional conduct rules in Pennsylvania that bar attorneys from bringing frivolous proceedings without a basis in law or fact and prohibit conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. These charges against Rudy Giuliani can lead to the suspension of a license to practice law or disbarment. The charges mark the second time that a bar office has taken action against Rudy Giuliani. His New York law license was suspended in June of 2021 after a state appeals court found that Giuliani made demonstrably false and misleading statements that widespread voter fraud undermined the election. Apart from having two of his law licenses suspended, Giuliani's reputation has been stained by his dealings with Ukraine, and he is being investigated by Manhattan federal prosecutors over those business ties with Ukraine. He began representing Donald Trump, a fellow Republican and New Yorker, in April of 2018, in connection with then-special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation that documented Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Rudy Giuliani has not been charged with criminal wrongdoing. His lawyer has said the federal investigation is politically motivated. Meanwhile, Thursday's opening session of primetime televised hearings into storming of Capitol Hill on 6th of January 2021 was both revealing and disturbing. The revelations of what exactly took place when a violent mob broke into the halls of U.S. Congress seeking to overturn a Democratic election by preventing the formal certification of Joe Biden's victory are a valuable and shocking addition to the historical record. The House of Representatives Committee that has been investigating the attempted insurrection for the past year, gathering in excess of 140,000 documents and speaking to more than 1,000 witnesses, discovered that Donald Trump's response on learning that the rioters were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," his vice president was to say that his vice president deserved it. Previously unseen video footage and fresh testimony buried the suggestion made by one Republican congressman that the behavior of the insurrectionists on 6th of January 2021 was like a normal tourist visit, or that it was, as Fox News' most watched host, Tucker Carlson, was still insisting on Thursday, no more than a forgettable minor outbreak of violence. Instead, one police officer, Caroline Edwards, who suffered a traumatic brain injury as the Capitol was breached on 6th of January 2021, described being stampeded, knocked unconscious, pepper-sprayed and tear-gassed by the rioters. There was so much blood on the floor, she slipped over. It was carnage, she said. It was chaos. Operation Cyanide. Part 2.
Operation Cyanide. If I heard about it, I heard so.
What was it?
I suggest we stop the interview here. What do you say? Why you want it? I'm built so, and I know exactly what I'm able to tell you. And I know exactly where I stop. And here I stop.
Why would you not be able to speak about Operation Cyanide?
Signature and loyalty to my country.
On June 8, 1967, news spreads around the world which wasn't easy to believe. Unknown attackers target a U.S. military ship in the Mediterranean Sea. After World War II, this was the first time someone had dared to attack the U.S. military. April 30th, 1945, when an all-out rivalry broke out between the Western Allies and the USSR to conquer Berlin, soldiers of the Red Army reached the heart of Nazi Germany sooner than the Americans. With the fall of the city and Adolf Hitler committing suicide, the flames of the horrendous Second War in Europe burnt out. The death and destruction, as World War II was coming to an end, the two powerful conquerors could raise their flags on the mountains of soil and ashes and reorganize world order the way they wanted to. The Eastern powerhouse was the USSR, which had the dream of spreading the ideals of communism and saving the masses of the labor force from the oppression of capitalists. And on the other side, the wealthy Western powerhouse, meaning the U.S., was standing on the principles of using capital to create welfare. The USSR was doing everything in its power to entice the masses toward communist ideals and turn governments into its allies. When Gamal Abdel Nasser received word that Israeli forces had amassed on the Syrian border, he wasted no time. He immediately wrote to the UN and asked the organization to withdraw its peacekeeping forces, which had been stationed on the border of the neighboring countries from the previous war between Egypt and Israel. Nasser wanted to fill up the entire border Egypt had with this unwanted neighbor with his own military forces. It seemed the Soviets' plot for a war between the ideologies of the East and the West in the Middle East had really worked. Nasser took a further step, that putting his forces on standby and shut down the strategic straits of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba. The Straits of Tiran were the only waterway access Israel had with the eastern part of the world. The only passageway for the Israelis to import fuel had been shut down to the Zionists, and with this, war became inevitable. June 5th, 7 in the morning, 180 Israeli fighter jets flew towards Egypt. Only 12 fighter jets were left behind to defend the Israeli skies. Minutes later, Egypt's military airport runways were bombed, and 280 Egyptian military jets on the ground were the targets of Israeli rockets. The Egyptians were so overwhelmingly surprised that they didn't even find the time to start their jet engines. The next target for Israeli fighter jets was Syria. 2 hours later, the Syrian Air Force was totally destroyed. And in only a few minutes, Jordan's Air Force had been dealt a heavy blow by Israeli fighters. This extraordinary surprise attack could not have been carried out without detailed intelligence superiority. On the Sinai Desert, where Egyptian and Israeli armored units had lined up against each other, the Egyptians had the upper hand in military force. Egypt had three times the number of tanks that the Israelis did, but there was no air cover to keep the Sinai sky safe for the Egyptians. The Egyptians had no option but to retreat. The orders to retreat in the Sinai Desert came from the office of General Abdul Hakim Amer, the Egyptian war minister. But there was no plan for it. The unplanned retreat of the Egyptians began, and the Israeli fighter jets used the opportunity the best they could and devastated the Egyptians. When the USSR realized that in the matter of hours, the balance of military power in the war in the Middle East had switched dramatically in favor of Israel, it gave 48 of its MiG fighter jets to fly from Ukraine to Armenia's naval base to prepare for an attack against Israel. On the other hand, the Kremlin activated the hotline between the U.S. and the USSR so that Kosygin's ultimatum could be delivered to Washington. The text contained the message that since the U.S. is Israel's supporter, we ask you to stop the continuation of Israel's aggression against Egyptian soil.
About 7:15, the telephone rang. It was the duty officer in the war room. Mr. Secretary, Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. He wishes to speak to the president. The president came on the line. He said, in effect, God damn it, Bob, what are you calling me for at this time in the morning? I said, Mr. President, Prime Minister Kosygin's on the hotline. How do you wish to respond?
Johnson didn't want the situation to turn into a military confrontation with the USSR. He immediately sent word to Moscow that with the help of the USSR and the UN, the U.S. will use any means to put an end to the war. The first day of war was nearing midday when, in a televised speech, Eshkol and King Hussein and the rest of the Arabs.
He appealed to King Hussein and to other neighbors to stay their hand, and Israel would do likewise.
But King Hussein didn't take the advice so seriously. Therefore, at 10:30 in the morning of the 5th of June, Al-Quds came under the attack of Jordan's artillery forces. But the Jordanians weren't able to do anything either, and the old city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, which they had control of before the war, fell to the Israelis. The Six-Day War was in its third day as the main battle was taking place somewhere far from where the Arabs and Israelis were fighting, in the depths of the Mediterranean waters. The U.S. was unhappy about the USSR's dominance over the Middle East. To confront communism from spreading any more in the region, it was trying very hard to uncover the details of the relations the USSR had with Arabs in the Middle East. This motivated them to quietly snoop around the intelligence cables of Cairo and Moscow. But because it didn't want the issue to be revealed so that no one would find out about it, everyone else had to be busy dealing with another crisis. The third day of the war was reaching the evening when the Liberty reached the international waters in the north of Egypt and Israel, and it transmitted the initial news of Israel's victories and the conquest of the old city of Al-Quds to the NSA. But the question, which had kept the officers on board the Liberty busy, was why an unarmed military ship should be present in the vicinity of a conflict zone without an armed escort and be left all alone. The commander of the Liberty, Captain William McGonagall, asked this question from the commander of the U.S. Navy's 6th Fleet, which had retreated 100 miles from the region.
We were told there was no need to worry. We had asked Commander 6th Fleet for an armed guard to go along with us, a destroyer. He sent the message back saying we were in international waters, flying the American ensign. There was no need for an armed escort.
When Egypt and Jordan were removed from Israel's path, it was time for the Golan Heights on the border between Israel and Syria to come under the watchful eyes of the Israelis. 12 hours later, and with heavy fire of fighter jets and artillery forces, not only did the Syrians retreat from Israel's borders, but the Golan Heights were also occupied by the Israelis. A few kilometers away from the war zone, on the fourth day of the battle, the officers and crew of the Liberty had just woken up and were busy with their morning activities. A while later, several unknown planes got closer to the ship and encircled it many times to completely identify the ship. The planes didn't display any flags on their bodies, and the Liberty's crew wasn't able to identify which country they belonged to. But the recorded conversation of the pilot and watchtower shows that the planes had identified the Liberty well. few hours later, when it was a few minutes past 2 p.m., three Mirage jets, which still didn't have the insignia of any country, got close to the Liberty and bombed the ship as much as they could with their rockets. But the main question was which side of the war may have attacked the Liberty, Egypt or Israel? As a wounded and astonished crew was thinking about the Egyptians don't even have Mirage jets, something else happened. 3 minutes later, unknown Mystere jets reached the Liberty and targeted the half-burned ship with a napalm bomb. When the Liberty was burning under the fire of attacking jets, three unannounced guests which were displaying the American flag were watching the events unfold from beneath the waters in the region and were informing the Pentagon of every single moment of what was happening. The telecommunications officers of the ship were trying their best to transmit news of the attack to the 6th Fleet and ask them for help. But the noise that the attack jets were sending on the Liberty's frequencies to transmit communications prevented the transfer of the messages.
Here's a question I have to ask. Who would know the frequencies other than an ally? And who was the ally in the war? It wasn't Egypt. It was Israel.
In the end, one of the Liberty's transmissions reached the USS America warship, and the commander of the ship issued orders for two U.S. fighter jets to take off to defend the Liberty.
So all of this happens. They call, guys, help us. We're under attack. We're being engaged by torpedo boats and bombers and fighters, and we need your help. And they're locking down bulkheads and burning, and people are dying, and they're strafing lifeboats against the Geneva Convention and all the rules of war and common sense and decency. Because they had to kill everybody. And McNamara comes on and says, you will not launch a wing. We're not going to do that.
But as soon as word reached the White House that the jets had taken off to defend the Liberty, the defense secretary sent an urgent message to the 6th Fleet and asked the commander of the fleet to immediately return his jets back to the warship without asking any questions. Since Admiral Gates was shocked by this strange order, he contacted Washington to remind them that an American warship is under fire by unknown planes and asked why he shouldn't act to support the ship. In the end, he told McNamara to implement such strange order and return the jets which had taken off to support the Liberty. He needed orders from a more superior position. This time, President Johnson spoke and told Geist that he wanted that damn ship to sink and had no intentions in upsetting his ally. Order the jets to fly back, he said.
The Admiral ignores it and they go ahead and launch the wings. They're not calling them back, they've been launched. And then all of a sudden, over the radio line comes the telephone call, patched in, it's the President. I want that going to the bottom. That's a quote.
But when even the witnesses to the event didn't know whether the attacks were being carried out by the Egyptians or the Israelis, how did Johnson know that the fighter jets belonged to his friends and ally Israel? Sometime later, Johnson, accompanied by McNamara and the Secretary of State Dean Rusk and a number of the government's advisors, gathered in the White House's Situation Room to come to the conclusion that the party to blame for the crisis is Egypt. Therefore, this time, the hotline between Washington and Moscow was activated by the White House. The message was, a U.S. warship has been attacked by unknown fighter planes in international waters in the north of Egypt, and the only suspect in this attack is the ally of the USSR, meaning Egypt. The White House wants to respond to this attack with a nuclear attack on Cairo. The orders for the attack reached the 6th Fleet. Without wasting any time, Three U.S. fighter jets were equipped with nuclear weapons and flew toward the Egyptian capital. Word of an inevitable attack on Cairo reached Richard Parker, the U.S. political consul in Cairo, first.
There was this message that the Navy was preparing to retaliate against Egypt for the attack on the Liberty. They thought that it was the Egyptians who attacked it. They were preparing to attack Egypt in response.
It was 2:30 p.m. when three Israeli torpedo boats got close to the half-burnt Liberty and fired five torpedoes at it. One of them hit the middle of the ship and created a huge hole in its starboard side. Due to the torpedo attacks, the ship's propulsive forces stopped working, and the transmitting systems were totally destroyed. At the same time that U.S. jets armed with nuclear weapons were on the way to Cairo, Robert McNamara, the U.S. Defense Secretary, contacted the USS America of the Sixth Fleet so he could deliver another strange order to the commander of the ship. McNamara asked Geist to immediately recall the jets which were en route to Cairo. Early next morning, the USS America, USS Davis, and USS Massey arrived to remove the 34 dead sailors and 174 naval officers from the burnt-down Liberty and transfer the warship to Malta for repairs. An hour later, Admiral Isaac Kidd, who was put in charge of investigating the Liberty incident, arrived on the scene to hear what the victims had to say so he can offer a written report to his superiors. After the suspicious Liberty incident, word of the bizarre Israeli attack on the U.S. warship spread around the world. Israelis claimed they'd mistaken the Liberty with the Egyptian ship Al-Qusair. This is while the Al-Qusair was a retired cargo ship and wasn't even half the size of the USS Liberty.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
At least 16 recipients of the European Research Council ERC grants making plans to reject UK offer and move their laboratories abroad, as the United Kingdom remains frozen out of the European Union's flagship science programme. We now present you an article written by Hannah Devlin. The piece is titled Brexit Row Could Prompt Exodus of Senior Scientists from UK. The United Kingdom is facing an exodus of star scientists, with at least 16 recipients of prestigious European grants making plans to move their laboratories abroad, as the UK remains frozen out of the European Union's flagship science programme. Britain's participation in Horizon Europe has been caught in crosshairs of the dispute over Brexit in Northern Ireland, meaning that 143 UK-based recipients of European Research Council fellowships recently faced a deadline of either relinquishing their grant or transferring it to an institute in an eligible country. The British government has promised to underwrite the funding, totalling about £250 million, but a growing number of scientists appear likely to reject the offer and instead relocate, along with entire teams of researchers. The European Research Council, ERC, said 16 academics had recently informed it that they intend to move their laboratories abroad or are in negotiations about doing so. These researchers and some others have been given an extension before their grants are terminated. Moritz Treek, a group leader at the Francis Crick Institute in London, who is due to receive €2 million over 5 years from the European Research Council, ERC, to study the malaria pathogen, is among those contemplating a move. Maurice Treig said, "A major downside of the UK offer was the lack of flexibility about moving the funding internationally." He said, "It personally makes me very angry. The UK Research Institute really put up a wall for scientists to move the funding. It's all nationalist stuff. It's not about science." The Guardian heard from three other senior academics planning to move, who wished to remain anonymous because they were negotiating contracts. One, a biology professor at a top-ranking university, awarded a €2 million grant, said the impasse over Britain's participation in European Union programmes had already been hugely disruptive. She said, "I feel heartbroken to be put into this position." She added, "Either I leave at huge personal and professional cost, or I stay and miss out on career-changing opportunities. This was supposed to be a massive achievement and recognition of our standing as scientists. Instead, I feel hugely stressed." Another said the offer to match the €2 million funding she had been awarded to research the roots of populism in the 21st century would not replace the prestige of European Research Council grants, widely viewed as the Champions League of academic fellowships. She said, "European Research Council, ERC, is a label that is internationally recognised as excellence. For me, as a Latin American immigrant, it's really something that changes my career in Europe. I worked on this proposal for 2 years, and I didn't want to give up something that I really struggled to get." A third senior scientist who plans to transfer a €2 million ERC grant to study the response of animals to climate change to an institute outside of Britain said, "My main motivator for choosing to move is that I lack trust in UK governmental institutions and processes after what I've witnessed since moving here. The loss of these academics is a blow to the British government's proposed bold global alternative to Horizon." Recently, the Science Minister, George Freeman, called on the European Union not to weaponize science for politics before a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, but said the United Kingdom was ready to press ahead with its Plan B if the dispute is not resolved. Others who are remaining in the United Kingdom said they had been left in limbo, with little clarity on when the UK Research Institute funding will be available. Professor Ben Sheldon, an ecologist at the University of Oxford, who was awarded a €3.1 million grant to study the effect of human-caused climate change in the timing of seasonal events in Oxford's Witham Woods, said, "We've heard nothing at all, which is one of the disturbing things. It's like a black hole." Professor Ben Sheldon said the uncertainty about funding meant he could not start recruiting the four PhD students, four postdoctoral graduates and technicians needed for the project, and since the research focused on seasonal phenomena, this could delay the work by up to a year. He said, "These are major research programs. You can't just recruit people to start the next day," adding, "It's hugely destabilizing." A spokesperson for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "Successful awardees do not need to leave the United Kingdom to receive funding," adding, "We recognise the European Union's delays to formalising the UK's association to Horizon Europe have led to uncertainty for researchers, for businesses and innovators based in the United Kingdom." The spokesperson for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "This is why the government has guaranteed funding for eligible successful applicants to Horizon Europe, who are expected to sign grant agreements by December of 2022, and who have been unable to sign grant agreements with the European Union. This includes European Research Council winners, claiming, "The guarantee means that eligible successful applicants will receive the full value of their funding at their UK host institution for the lifetime of their grant." Moreover, it has emerged that British universities are facing a brain drain as a row over Brexit in Northern Ireland threatens £250 million in research funding from the European Union. The European Research Council, ERC, has written to 98 scientists and academics who were recently approved for €172 million in grants, telling them that if the UK's associate membership of the €80 billion Horizon Europe programme is not ratified, they will not be eligible to draw down the money. Scientists have said they're now scrambling to find alternative EU institutions to host the funding, and some already turning down the European Research Council money and hoping the British government's promise of replacement cash will be delivered. But they say in either case it is devastating, as the European Research Council is considered one of the most prestigious programmes in the world. The then Brexit Secretary David Frost fought hard to get associate membership of Horizon Europe as part of the trade deal negotiations in 2020, but ratification has been delayed while Britain fails to implement the Northern Ireland Protocol. British scientists say they are being punished. Payam Gamage, a scientist at the Beatson Institute at Glasgow University, said, "It's a strange choice for the European Union. The United Kingdom isn't going to notice it immediately. It will take a long time to have any impact. All that happens is a bunch of scientists have a lot of opportunities taken away or their lives just made a lot more difficult. We're the only victims." Gamage was awarded a €2 million award to expand research on mitochondrial genetics and mutations in tumours, but has decided to turn down the European Research Council grant and apply for replacement funding from the UK Research and Innovation Fund. He said this was not the same, as there was no detail about the terms and conditions of funding. Gamage said the idea that Britain could replicate the system and apparatus of something like the European Research Council in the near to medium term is, at best, unrealistic. Seymour Fetzer, a professor of economics at Warwick University, who was approved for €1.5 million funding, said, "We all had reason to believe that the UK Association was just a matter of the UK implementing the free trade agreement. Now we're waking up to the reality. It is very devastating." A molecular biologist who was awarded a €2 million fund for a 5-year research programme said she would now be looking to commute to Ireland or to Belgium. She said, "My main priority is getting the funding because an award at this level of funding happens once in a lifetime." Starter grants are worth €1.5 million each, and consolidator grants are worth up to €2 million each, with a further round of advanced grants due to the awarded next month, worth up to €2.5 million each, which could take the overall UK funding to about €300 million. Britain's Science Minister George Freeman has pledged to extend the guaranteed replacement funding until December of 2022. The President of the European Research Council, Professor Maria Leptin, said she was fervently hoping that the UK-EU negotiations would be finalised and result in association with Horizon Europe. She said, "Our letters to grantees had to point out the option for portability of the grant outside of the United Kingdom, but nobody here has any wish at all to entice anyone to leave the UK."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A former head of Israeli regime's Mossad spy agency was deported from the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2019 after it emerged that he was involved in a plot to overthrow the country's president. During his visit to the DRC, the top Mossad spy was accompanied by Israeli oligarch Dan Gertler, who is involved in looting Congo's mineral resources, such as cobalt, while indigenous people are languishing in poverty. A Congolese professor elaborates here on how plundering by capitalists such as Gertler has destroyed the country. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Israeli regime's destabilization activities in Africa. The Tel Aviv regime dispatched its top spy to the Democratic Republic of Congo to plan a coup against a democratically elected government. So why is the Tel Aviv regime meddling in the DRC? This is one of the questions our expert will be answering. The second part of our program will be on some of the challenges Africa faces in improving energy access as it seeks to industrialize. So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis.
Mossad meddling in the DRC. The former chief of Israel's Mossad spy agency, Yossi Cohen, was humiliated after he was deported from the Democratic Republic in 2019. According to media reports, his ejection from Kinshasa came after the country's president obtained classified reports that the Mossad chief was planning a coup against him. The expose on the Israeli regime's plot to overthrow DRC's government comes when the regime has been lobbying to be an observer member of the African Union.
Leading Pan-Africanist Pierre Lumumba in voicing his opposition to the Israeli regime's observer status at the AU said the Tel Aviv regime might be pursuing hidden objectives in its attempt to infiltrate Africa.
"I find no merit in Israel enjoying observer status at the African Union. And thirdly, I am puzzled why that is important at all. I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU. unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Well, for more on the Israeli regime's meddling in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Kambale Musavuli, a human rights activist and an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, can you give us a brief account on what led to the humiliating expulsion of the Mossad spy agency chief in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
We know that Congo, the Congolese president, became very close to Israel. I believe that he felt that by becoming close to Israel, that would give him some cover to rule the Congo and control the country. But it was a surprise to him that while he was close to Israel, there was something else happening. The first visit is unclear of when it took place. The second visit, we know, took place on October 9th of 2019, right when the president of the Congo was traveling to the eastern part of the country. And it's very important to look at that context. The head of Mossad came into the DRC when the president of the Congo was traveling to the east, and at the same time, the same day he was traveling to the east, one of the planes with Congolese soldiers and some of his vehicles, the bulletproof vehicles and so on, got into an accident, right? There was a plane crash of the presidential convoy. So that raised a lot of suspicion about why the Mossad head was in DRC unannounced twice already, without the country knowing why he was coming there.
During his visit to Kinshasa, the Mossad chief was in the company of Gertler, one of former President Joseph Kabila's closest business cronies. This corrupt Zionist wheeler dealer is said to have bribed Congolese authorities to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in exchange for mining rights in the DRC. Gertler recently signed a deal with the current government in Kinshasa that would allow the DRC to recover looted mining and oil assets of Gertler's company Ventura, worth more than $2 billion. That's a colossal amount of money looted from a country with some of the poorest people on earth. Is Mossad involved in the looting of DRC's wealth?
The New York Times had an expose that explained who Doug Gertler was. Cohen traveling to DRC with Dan Gertler may be a shock to people, but we in the DRC, especially at the Center for Research of the Congo, we have studied for quite some time Dan Gertler's dealing in the DRC. We're not that surprised. He's a very powerful businessman in the DRC. He's made billions of dollars on shady deals in the DRC. And in the New York Times expose that I'm referencing, it was clearly stated that he is an intelligence asset for Mossad and serves for U.S. national interests in Central Africa.
The Israeli regime has close ties with the former and current DRC president, and this has raised questions on what Cohen was really pursuing in Kinshasa. Now, is it possible that different Israeli regime factions are competing for the control of the DRC, especially since the current president, Felix Tshisekedi, who was reportedly almost deposed by Mossad, also enjoys close ties with the Israeli regime?
The engagement of Felix to Israel has been to continue the policies of his predecessors, of using Israel as the space or the country for access for intelligence tools. Some of the Israeli companies have been engaged in the Congo. NSO, that pretty much manufactured or created the Pegasus virus. NSO is still operating in the DRC. There is no indication that they have stopped under the Tshisekedi regime. We know there are other Israeli interests there. But the most important under the Felix regime, the most important engagement is that under his regime and under his the Congo being the chairman of the African Union, the DRC played a central role with the chairperson of the AU Commission to recognize Israel as a member state of the African Union. So that's why Israel needed the DRC.